want, as powerful as you want. He knows it would be tough politically to do.
Sorry
and
to jump in. Sorry to jump in, Margaret Kimberly.
Responsibility.
My bad. We're just out of time. I did not note the time there, but I do apologize. Margaret Kimberly, co-founder of the Black Agenda Report. Thank you. Anyways, Richard Becker, thank you. Anti-war activist from the Answer Coalition. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yikovet Tavwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحيي حياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed, and He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli forces killed 10 Palestinians in their most violent raids so far this year in the occupied West Bank. Hamas hails rocket attacks by resistance groups on Israeli positions, saying Palestinians have the right to fight the regime's aggression. And Peruvian police clash with anti-government protesters during fresh rallies in the capital, Lima. World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Israeli forces have conducted a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern occupied West Bank, killing 10 Palestinians and injuring many others. The raid took place on Thursday, making it the deadliest day since the beginning of the year. The latest fatalities bring to 30 the number of Palestinians killed in the occupied West Bank this year.
Thousands of people have taken part in the funeral procession of Palestinians killed in the Israeli forces raid on the West Bank city of Jenin Thursday. Carrying the martyrs' bodies, the mourners chanted slogans condemning the Israeli crimes. It was early Thursday when Palestinian media reported the regime forces raid on the Jenin refugee camp. The savage attack left the residents and popular resistance groups based in the camp with no choice but to defend themselves and confront the regime forces.
What happened today in Jenin Governorate is a massacre in the very sense of the word. We received 8 martyrs and 1 martyr in Ibn Sina Hospital. In addition to 18 wounded, 3 of them are in a very serious condition. Most of the injuries were due to direct targeting with the aim of killing.
Later in the day, the Israeli troops fatally shot another Palestinian in the town of Al-Ram, near the occupied city of Al-Quds. The Palestinian was killed during a protest against the Israeli forces' raid on Jenin. With a total death toll of 10, January 26th turned into one of the deadliest days in the occupied West Bank since Israel's military raids intensified at the start of last year. Iran's foreign ministry reacted to the bloody incident. It called on Muslim countries to unite and coordinate their actions in support of the oppressed Palestinian nation and the resistance to stop the apartheid regime's acts of terror. Palestinian resistance groups have also condemned the Israeli atrocity in the strongest words, calling for continued resistance against the regime.
The massacre that the Israeli occupation army committed in Jenin confirms the racist, fascist and criminal nature of the right-wing occupation government. This aggression, in addition to the continued violations at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and of the rights of the Palestinians in Israel, shows that this government insists on escalating the situation.
Our resistance will carry on and shall not back off from confronting this Zionist occupier, and the killing will not intimidate us and will not be intimidated by these threats made by the criminal leaders of this Zionist entity.
Palestinian resistance movements say the latest Israeli raid on Jenin comes within the context of recent escalations, especially in light of the new far-right cabinet headed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his extremist allies. Hamas and Islamic Jihad have both expressed readiness to fight back in case these raids continue. Analysts believe that Palestinians need to bolster resistance against Israel to neutralize the regime's vicious plots.
The resistance should continue and should be escalated against the Israeli, and they should know that they should pay the price for all crimes they are committing.
Actually, they mean to eliminate the resistance in the West Bank, in the occupied West Bank, to pave the way to construct more Israeli settlements in the West Bank, in which we all know that these settlements are internationally illegal.
Jenin is among those areas in the northern West Bank where Israel intensified its raids over the past year in an attempt to crack down on the Palestinian resistance. In addition to Palestinian resistance fighters, civilians confronting the Israeli army during such raids and even bystanders have been killed mercilessly. More than 170 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, were killed across the occupied West Bank last year. Moreover, at least 29 Palestinians, including 5 children, have been killed in January 2023 alone.
Meanwhile, Israeli aircraft have carried out multiple airstrikes in the besiege of the Gaza Strip. According to Palestinian media, the Israeli strikes hit positions of Palestinian groups in different locations in the Gaza Strip. The strikes came hours after Palestinians fired rockets on Israeli settlements. They did so in response to the regime's bloody raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. A spokesman for the resistance movement, Hamas, has hailed the Palestinian response. Hazem Qasim said the Palestinian people and their resistance groups have the right to fight in the face of aggression by the Israeli regime. He said resistance groups in Gaza will continue to defend Palestinians and their sanctities. Our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, gives details about the resistance group's response to the Israeli airstrikes and says the groups have promoted their military capabilities.
This morning, Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasim said that the Israeli bombardment and aggression against the Gaza Strip is a continuation of what the Israeli regime is doing in the occupied West Bank, mainly in the refugee camp of Jenin. Qasim hailed the actions by the resistance factions in Gaza, especially their use of SAM-7 rockets, surface-to-air missiles against Israeli aircraft as they were bombing the Gaza Strip around midnight last night. The Israeli regime fighter jets attacked Gaza with at least a dozen rockets. They mainly targeted an area in Al-Maghazi refugee camp. It's a Hamas training center. They also fired three rockets at a Hamas security post in the south of Gaza City. Also, Israeli tanks fired at the Hamas security post in the east of Gaza. Every Israeli war against Gaza, let's start from 2008, 2012, 2014, 2021, and even the escalation in August 2022. Palestinian resistance groups have been increasing the capabilities of their weapons and increasing the distance how far those rockets are hitting inside Israeli-occupied areas. And also the use of the SAM-7 rockets, this is like the fourth or fifth time that they've been using this. Like years before they didn't have them. Now they have them.
Turning elsewhere now, Iran has censured some regional countries for using a fake name for the Persian Gulf, saying the move contravenes the principles of good neighborly relations. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani made the remark in reaction to the use of a fake name for the Persian Gulf by some Iraqi officials. He said the Iranian Foreign Ministry has sent an official memo to the Iraqi side describing the move as unacceptable. The Iranian diplomat stressed that the Persian Gulf has been known by this name for thousands of years in all ancient documents, maps, and travelogues. Kanani added that using, quote, baseless words cannot change this reality. He said the Iraqi officials should not try to win over other countries' friendship at the cost of the historical solidarity among regional countries. Peru's capital, Lima, has been the scene of yet another protest against the government of President Dina Boluarte. Despite her call for a national truce, police have used tear gas to disperse the crowd. Protests have continued unabated in Peru ever since former President Pedro Castillo was removed from office and arrested in December. He is now in pretrial detention over attempts to shut down Congress to avoid an impeachment. The protesters want his release. They also want his successor, President Boluarte, to step down and hold early elections. At least 50 people have been killed during weeks-long protests in Peru. The president has condemned the unrest and called for a national truce earlier this week. Her government says police will soon move to dismantle roadblocks put by the protesters on highways countrywide. That comes as shortage of basic goods have escalated. French protesters have held a torchlight march in the capital, Paris, against a controversial pension reform that would increase the retirement age from 62 to 64. This is the latest in a series of protests and strikes that have rocked France in recent weeks. Despite the public discontent, President Emmanuel Macron's government went ahead with the plan, presenting it at a cabinet meeting on Monday. The plan still needs to go through Parliament. Macron's government says raising the retirement age aims to balance the system's books. The opposition rejects that, accusing Macron of trying to stamp his authority on the country. Trade unions plan to step up their protests until the reform plan is dropped. A strike is scheduled for next Tuesday. Now, the United Kingdom and Canada say they will send heavy tanks to Ukraine following similar decisions by the United States and Germany. The British government says it will send 14 Challenger 2 tanks by the end of March. It added that training of Ukrainian soldiers in how to use and maintain those tanks will start next week. Canada, for its part, said it will supply heavy tanks to Ukraine, starting with a shipment of 4 fully operational German Leopards. The new development came after Germany promised to provide Ukraine with its Leopard tanks by the end of March. Following Berlin's announcement, the US said it would send 31 Abrams tanks to bolster Ukraine in its war with Russia. Russia has dismissed, meanwhile, as a provocation, a report by the UN nuclear watchdog about powerful explosions near Ukraine's Zaporizhzhia nuclear power station. The reaction came after the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency said that the vicinity of the plant had been rocked by 8 strong blasts. An advisor to the head of the company that operates Russia's nuclear plants said Rafael Grossi's comments were unfounded. He said Grossi's remarks were aimed at convincing Western public opinion that Russia cannot uphold safety of nuclear plants. Zaporizhzhia is the largest nuclear power plant in Europe and among the 10 largest in the world. Russian forces took control of the plant soon after the Ukraine war started on February 24.
The United States has decided to give Ukraine 31 battle tanks, the most powerful offensive weapons the Pentagon has sent yet. The increased direct involvement by Washington and its NATO allies hinders chances for a diplomatic solution and has led to open threats of an escalation into nuclear war.
We heard Annalena Baerbock say in the Council of Europe Tuesday or Wednesday of this week that we are at war with Russia. And so there's no, you know, there's no question about what's really, you know, what's really going on here. And there's certainly no question in the minds of people in Russia who have all this weaponry being wheeled up to their borders.
The announcement came just one day after Ukraine's government saw its biggest corruption scandal and mass resignation since the unrest with Russia began, bringing down a top presidential advisor and a dozen leading officials. Public support for Ukraine has fallen almost 25% from its highest level last March. Recent polls show that 53% disapprove of the way President Joe Biden is handling the situation, and that 47% of Americans want Kiev to settle for peace soon. The same poll noted that if people think Ukraine is winning the war, then they are much more supportive of more aid.
What are you sending the money for? Well, protect freedom and, well, it's being successful. Okay, some people will buy that. If it's not being successful, the number of people that will buy that goes down precipitously. And so that's, you know, the happy talk is necessary to make it seem like we're not just opening the window and pouring the money out onto a flame or whatever.
Since last year, Ukraine has received over $50 billion in military aid from the West, which is slightly more than Russia's entire 2022 defense budget. However, the Republican takeover of the House of Representatives has included promises to rein in the Democratic Party's war spending, as polls say over half of Republicans no longer support funding Ukraine. Kiev has already shifted their demands to fighter jets, which will be the next debate within NATO. The conflict continues to escalate, with few voices for diplomacy heard within the United States. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The U.S. president has called for protests to be peaceful after five police officers were charged in the death of a black man following a traffic stop. Joe Biden said he understands people's outrage at the incident, adding, however, that violence is never acceptable. He admitted that more steps must be taken to ensure that the U.S. criminal system is fair and impartial. Biden's remarks came after five officers were charged with second-degree murder over the fatal beating of young black man Tyree Nichols on January 7. His family says Nichols was so brutalized that his body was almost unrecognizable. Police brutality against African Americans has been a major source of public outcry in the U.S., and that came more strongly in the spotlight after the 2020 death of George Floyd.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The all-knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely, thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Iran's domestic production capacities. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As you know, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, dubs every Iranian calendar year with a theme which fits to the conditions of the time. The leader named this year as the year of production, knowledge-based, job-creating. The themes of the year are chosen by Ayatollah Khamenei to motivate the officials and the people towards putting the internal potential capacities into effect to push the country on the course of progress. Thus, we have prepared a series to briefly review Iran's capacities in various fields. In the fifth episode of this series, you will get familiar with Iran's capacities in the field of oil and gas. Stay tuned, please. Oil industry is the greatest industry in the world, especially in the oil-producing countries like the Islamic Republic of Iran. The first oil well in Iran was exploited in Masjid Soleiman region of Khuzestan province in 1908. No doubt, energy has been the most important section of Iran's economy ever since, because it has secured major part of the country's revenues. The share of oil revenues has been 46% in average since 1971 to 2018. Oil has enjoyed high status in Iran's general budget for the past two decades, and it has been more than 41%. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been one of the important members of Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, for over half a century. This has been true for gas, too. In view of this, Iran's economic and political relations have been considered to a significant extent with regards to its position in the field of energy. Iran is a very rich country with respect to natural resources. Iran's proved crude reserves put it in the fourth place after Venezuela, Arabia, and Canada, while it stands in the second rank after Russia in terms of gas reserves. The proved oil reserves of the Islamic Republic of Iran amount to nearly 160 billion barrels, and this number is 34 trillion cubic meters for gas. According to the statistics of Iran's oil ministry, approximately half of the proved oil reserves have been extracted in the world. Although Iran was one of the first countries which started production of commercial oil, it has extracted a little more than one-third of its reserves. During 40 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, 36 oil fields and 37 gas fields have been discovered in the country. The results of oil and gas discoveries indicate that 25% of the oil reserves have been discovered after the revolution, while this number is 75% for gas. Of oil discoveries have not been developed, and 77% of gas discoveries also have not been developed yet. The Islamic Republic of Iran, having 28 shared fields, including 18 oil fields, 4 gas fields, and 6 oil-gas fields with its neighbors, is among rare nations in this regard. Iran has 12 shared fields with Iraq, 7 shared fields with the UAE, 2 shared fields with Qatar, and 2 with Oman, and 1 shared field with each of Arabia, Kuwait, and Turkmenistan. In other words, nearly 50% of Iran's gas reserves are located in shared areas with neighboring nations. According to the U.S. Geological Organization, Iran enjoys the third status after Iraq and Russia in terms of new discoveries. The U.S. Energy Information Organization has stipulated that if Washington annuls its oppressive sanctions against Iran, the country will reach its full capacity of 3.8 million barrels production per day. This shows that there is a big bulk of oil and gas in the field of oil and gas, which can be effective in Iran's economy, particularly in petrochemicals, once sanctions are removed. It is also noteworthy that, unfortunately, the rate of energy consumption is much higher than global standards. According to the 2018 statistics, energy waste has been $16 to $17 billion. This means that the per capita energy consumption in Iran is 15 times more than Japan and 10 times more than the EU. Although the oppressive sanctions imposed on Iran by the U.S. and the United Nations Security Council have failed to bring the country to its knees, they have decreased the speed of exploitation of its capacities. Iran used to export 2.5 million barrels of oil per day before the U.S. illegal and unilateral exit from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, in 2018. But this rate dropped to nearly 200 barrels per day. Moreover, the illegal sanctions have prevented the entrance of modern technologies to the oil and gas section. Although the U.S. illegal sanctions have stymied Iran's forward movement in the fields of gas and oil and relevant technologies, knowledge-based companies have tried to modernize technologies via employing internal potentials of bright youths of various scientific spheres. New technologies in the fields of polymer, additives, and new substances, and also application of advanced technologies in wells, digital and artificial intellects have provided the grounds for modernization of oil industry, decrease of expenses, and increase of efficiency. Over 700 knowledge-based companies are active in the field of oil and gas to update the field.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
The Islamic Republic of Iran and South Korea recalled their ambassadors after a diplomatic dispute sparked by the statements of South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, who described Iran as the enemy of the United Arab Emirates. While visiting South Korean special forces stationed in the UAE, Yoon described the UAE as the brother nation of South Korea linked by increasing economic and military cooperation, that out of the blue compared the supposed threat the UAE faces from Iran to the threat South Korea faces from what Yoon called a nuclear-armed North Korea. Yoon's statements sparked angry reactions from the Iranian Foreign Ministry, which announced that it was investigating Yoon's interfering statements. How did the government of Seoul react to this diplomatic catastrophe? Well, the Seoul government confirmed that Yoon was seeking to encourage South Korean forces in the UAE and had no intention of commenting on Iran's foreign relations, urging the Iranian government against an unnecessary overinterpretation of his comments. Yes, overinterpretation is what Seoul calls the legitimate irritation felt across an entire sovereign nation, only because they have a Trumpian president who seemingly is not aware of what his mouth spouts, triggering a diplomatic row that will most definitely end badly for his country. In response to the Korean president's mishap, the Iranian Foreign Ministry said on its website that its Deputy Foreign Minister for Legal and International Affairs, Reza Najafi, lodged a strong protest over Yoon's meddlesome comments after summoning South Korean Ambassador Yun Kang-hyun. Najafi said during the meeting that Yoon's comments were tantamount to interference in what he described as Iran's friendly relations with most Persian Gulf states and undermined peace and security in the region. Well, it would not be a surprise to anyone if Tehran reconsiders bilateral ties with Seoul, given relations between both are already tense over billions of dollars in Iranian funds remaining in Seoul, frozen by American sanctions. I frankly feel sorry for the opposition members of parliament in Korea who criticized what happened, describing it as a diplomatic disaster. Even some members of Yoon's own party said he should have been more careful. But he wasn't, and now because of his remarks, Seoul has officially adopted a hostile approach towards the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome to the Mideast Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. South Korea and Iran recalled their ambassadors against the backdrop of a diplomatic dispute sparked by the statements of South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, who described Iran as the enemy of the United Arab Emirates during his visit to Abu Dhabi last week. The Iranian Foreign Ministry handed South Korea's ambassador to Tehran a strongly worded note of protest, stressing that it was studying and following up Yoon's intrusive remarks and awaiting an explanation from the foreign ministry in Seoul. To discuss this issue with us from New Jersey is Jesse Zurowell, an independent writer, editor, researcher, and photographer. Thank you for being with us, Jesse, to talk about this issue, which is, by the way, a bit weird. I mean, why would the South Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol, describe Tehran as the enemy of the United Arab Emirates while visiting Abu Dhabi? I mean, why on earth would the president of a sovereign country stir such an unnecessary pot that no one of the countries involved actually asked for?
I suspect it's because he wants to show the UAE, the US, and Israel in particular that South Korea is part of their club. And I think this stems from the fact that on this visit, a huge energy deal was brokered, a huge arms deal and investment deal was brokered, and the UAE pledged $30 billion over an undisclosed amount of time to South Korea in terms of these deals. And that's a huge amount when you consider the fact that it's almost double the UAE's federal budget for 2023. So I believe that the president of South Korea made such a statement to firm up the deal, but also to firm up any future deals, and again, to signal to the UAE, but also its allies in Washington and Tel Aviv, that South Korea is one of you, we're part of the club, and we want to remain part of the club going forward, and we will condemn Iran as you do, particularly Washington and Tel Aviv, to stay in the club as well. Now, whether that translates into anything action-wise remains to be seen. But I suspect that's where the South Korean president's harsh words for Iran come from.
Well, Yoon's remarks triggered a very stiff response from Iran's foreign ministry, which said it was investigating Yoon's interfering statements. Then we had also Iran's deputy foreign minister of legal affairs, Mr. Reza Najafi, summoning the South Korean ambassador last week to protest against his president's remarks while on his visit to Abu Dhabi. Now, in the event Iran does not actually receive a formal apology from South Korea, from the president or the government at least, how do you think that Iran will respond to such a diplomatic, basically, disaster?
It's hard to say, because Iran is, as history has shown us, very measured in its reactions to slights from other countries, whether they be big slights or small slights. So the Iranian government may just leave things be if they don't receive any formal apology, but they may go ahead with expelling the ambassador if they see fit. But I'm not so sure that Tehran would want to take such a drastic step, given the backlash that would ensue from that, and given the fact that today it was announced by the EU that another package of sanctions, as they like to call it, is going to be levied on Iran. And
especially
Iran,
there are already Iranian funds that are stuck in South Korea because of the American sanctions.
That's right. So I think Iran, in how measured it usually is in its responses, may not press the issue. And that's not because it's not upset or it's afraid to, but it's playing its cards wisely. So it remains to be seen what the response will be going forward, but I wouldn't be surprised if Tehran, if they don't receive a formal apology, just leaves things as they are, because they know how to play their cards wisely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, but something that's really interesting, which you mentioned earlier when you started the interview, described by Yoon's political opponents in South Korea as a diplomatic disaster. That spat comes at a time when he is doing all the meetings in the UAE, attempting to manage the country's relationship with the UAE, who is, by the way, a very important and strategic partner for Iran economically, the United Arab Emirates. But the UAE is also home to 3,500 American soldiers, and it has spent billions of dollars buying South Korean surface-to-air missile systems and other weaponry, of course. So what does Yoon's remark mean in the meantime, being there with the leaders of the UAE? I mean, if he said it on their land, can we say that they agree with it? They approve of it?
Well, it seems so far that that's the case, because I haven't seen any sort of retraction coming from the UAE in UAE press. I've looked for it. I haven't seen any formal statement on it. I haven't seen any statement whatsoever. I've just seen coverage of what Yoon has said, and it's been left at that, other than Tehran's response to what he said. I also want to point out, too, that there are South Korean military troops stationed in the UAE.
Which is also weird. There's a big question as to why.
Right. I'm not sure why that is, but in this day and age, I'm not surprised. But they are there, and I think that if we hear nothing from the UAE, we shouldn't be surprised. And I suspect that's what's going to happen, that we will hear nothing. And they're hoping this will blow over and not blow up into something bigger.
Because, I mean, if this is some sort of a signal that there will be some sort of an upping the ante against Iran by the United States camp, it does put the UAE in a very, very difficult position, don't you think?
Yes, it does. But I think that if it comes to an all-out campaign against Iran, that the UAE is going to choose sides against Iran. I have almost no doubt
about that. Can it afford to do so? It's basically in its backyard.
I don't know if it can afford to do so, but given the alliances it's maintained or preferred throughout history, particularly with regard to the West, with regard to its normalization with Israel, with regard to its close ties with South Korea, and the money involved in the investments and deals that were just brokered, I think it knows where its bread is buttered, and it would easily turn its back on Iran if need be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Jesse Zurawol, an independent writer, editor, researcher, and photographer, for being with us to discuss this new and pressing matter by the South Korean president against the Islamic Republic of Iran. But please do stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the human rights record in Saudi Arabia, which is just plummeting.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, a 66-year-old Saudi preacher and academic, Awad bin Muhammad al-Qarni, has been handed a death sentence for using social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, WhatsApp, and Telegram to spread news considered hostile to the kingdom. British newspapers stated that it had seen Saudi court documents and details of the charges against al-Qarni by his son, Nasser, who fled the kingdom in 2022 and is currently living in the United Kingdom after requesting protection in 2022. Now, the kingdom last year executed 147 people, including the mass execution of 81 humans in one day. And as of December 2022, at least 61 people faced the death penalty inside Saudi Arabia. More details in this following report.
In most countries, one can expect the punishment of death for crimes such as homicide or espionage. However, in Saudi Arabia, a famous law professor has been sentenced to death for alleged crimes including having a Twitter account and using WhatsApp to share news considered hostile to the kingdom. Awad al-Qarni, 65, an important pro-reform intellectual with a strong 2 million user following on Twitter, has been sentenced to death after he was arrested on September 2017 in a crackdown against dissent by the Saudi government under the new Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. But who is Awad al-Qarni? What are his alleged crimes? Why does the Saudi kingdom view him as dangerous? Awad al-Qarni is a Saudi preacher and academic who worked at the Imam Muhammad ibn Saud Islamic University in Riyadh and the King Khalid University. Al-Qarni has written several books on Islamic jurisprudence and the Palestinian cause. He's also a trainer in neurolinguistic programming. The 65-year-old cleric has also not shied away from voicing his opinions to the media and has been vocally critical of Saudi Arabia's arrests and travel bans on intellectuals in 2012. Hence why al-Qarni's critiques have portrayed him as a dangerous preacher, spreading conspiracy theories and extremist rhetoric against Mohammed bin Salman's so-called modernity. Following his arrest in 2017, al-Qarni's son, Nasser al-Qarni, left the kingdom in October 2022 and is now living in the UK and seeking his father's release. Nasser recently posted on Twitter that Saudi Arabia had slipped in many ways. Unfortunately, my country is falling down, not only in terms of human rights, but in all areas, socially, economically, and politically. Al-Qarni isn't the only individual to be arrested for voicing his opinion on social media inside Saudi Arabia. Last year, Salma Shahab, a Leeds PhD student and mother of two, received a 34-year sentence for having a Twitter account and for following and retweeting dissidents. Another woman identified as Noor al-Qahtani was sentenced to 45 years in prison for using Twitter. Multiple human rights groups and activists have reported on how the Saudi kingdom headed by Mohammed bin Salman has been cracking down on dissent, be it on social media or offline. Human Rights Watch, the international monitor, has reported how the authorities continue to target prominent clerics, academics, women and human rights activists, leading businessmen, and even other members of the royal family. Simultaneously, Saudi Arabia has increased its financial stake in companies such as Twitter and Facebook, causing concern that they may be misusing their power to breach people's privacy.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from London is Ms. Isra Al-Fas, who is a human rights advocate. Thank you very much for being with us, Isra, at this time of the day in the UK. Now, in 2022, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia executed 147 people, including the mass execution of 81 human beings in one day. And as of December of last year, also, we are expected to see 61 people facing the death penalty in Saudi Arabia, including cleric Awad al-Qarni. From your experience in such a file, does talking about it over and over again in the media ever bring change to the Saudi human rights violations?
Of course, this is very important, especially today. We are talking about a completely different experience inside Saudi Arabia. It is the experience of Mohammed bin Salman, who is primarily concerned with the image that emerges from within the kingdom. At the moment, any report in the media, any exposure of the violations taking place inside Saudi Arabia, bin Salman's regime cares to obscure it and to make it not go out into the open. Therefore, this is now a call to expose the criminality that is being practiced inside Saudi Arabia. And even the intimidation that is being practiced to silence voices by scaring the people with the threat of issuing death sentences. That being said, we obviously cannot trust the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which, for example, in a previous case, such as the case of the execution of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, where the Saudi regime had made promises and even sent promises to the family through foreign embassies that the Saudi regime would not implement the sentence against Sheikh Nimr. However, overnight, the regime carried out the sentence in a form of collective punishment, affecting even minor children, which is why I should make it clear. I do not trust the statements and assurances that come out from official Saudi Arabia. But yes, I believe that the pressure of exposing the image that Mohammed bin Salman is eager to beautify may actually lead to good results. Exposing them means that everything we see today and hear about leading to a new and different Saudi Arabia, about modernity and about transferring Saudi Arabia from one extreme to the other, is a false slogan whose only aim is to beautify Saudi ugliness.
Well, Awad al-Qarni, his specific case, who is a Saudi preacher and academic, he worked for the Mohammed bin Saud Islamic University and the King Khalid University as well, and who happened to voice his opinion about matters of his own country on social media. What happened to forgiveness, modernity, and the new Saudi Arabia that Mohammed bin Salman is preaching about it regularly?
The man you are referring to is a murderer. Mohammed bin Salman is a killer. He committed the most heinous crime in contemporary history, which is the crime of Jamal Khashoggi. He brazenly protected Jamal Khashoggi's killers. Those who carried out the crime did so at his own request. We are talking about a character described by German intelligence as mentally abnormal. Therefore, tolerance, forgiveness, and modernity are only slogans to present an image of a new Saudi Arabia, which Mohammed bin Salman wants to see emerging. Within it is his image as a king renewing the kingdom of moral decay, which comes as a successor to the Saudi Arabia of Mohammed bin Abdul Wahhab and his Wahhabi intellectual heritage. By the way, the current imprisoned dissent, Awad al-Qarni, was an official figure who has long been employed by the Saudi Arabian regime to justify the Saudi war against Yemen and to justify death sentences that had been carried out in the past against opponents who have political opinions that differ from the views of the Saudi regime. This is what is being practiced today against Awad al-Qarni. Awad al-Qarni himself was a silent witness. Furthermore, he was supportive of these same practices he endures today. And at some point, he legitimized what the official Saudi authorities were committing. Why do I say that? Because whoever accepts today that death sentences to be carried out against Awad al-Qarni and others may become its victims in the future. There is no immunity for any person inside the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Awad al-Qarni held an official academic position, one of the highest religious positions in the kingdom. He has a wide audience in the Islamic world and inside Saudi Arabia. However, he was arrested because of a simple tweet. He was arrested because he dared to voice his opinion. Today, he is in prison, unfortunately awaiting execution. We would not have heard of his case had it not been for the media exposing it. Besides Awad al-Qarni, there are people who represent the pinnacle of openness and moderation, such as Hassan Farhan al-Maliki. Why does his name not appear in the media today? if Mohammed bin Salman really wants to modify the extremist and terrorist image of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, then let him do so with a tolerant model the like of Hassan Farhan al-Maliki.
Well, another thing, Ms. Isra, that caught my attention, and I'm sure the attention of everyone who's following the case, is that Al-Qarni is being tried before the Specialized Criminal Court, the SCC in Saudi Arabia, which was established in 2008 to handle cases of terrorism. Cases of terrorism. But we are able to hear about the story because his son was able to flee the country and go to the UK and give the documents to UK media. But who knows how many cases there exist, the likes of Al-Qarni, that are not out in the media. For example, entire neighborhoods were erased in Al-Awamiya district in the eastern province of Al-Qatif in Saudi Arabia, and no one knows what happens to them. Do you have any idea what happened to those cases?
We are following up with what is happening with these cases from the limited information that are hardly extracted through social media, and whose owners are criminalized today for simply expressing admiration or interaction with a figure outside Saudi Arabia, who may have spoken about their people's demands or dared to highlight their sufferings. Confirming your words, Ms. Marwa, today Sheikh Hussein Al-Radi, who is languishing in Al-Khalifa prisons, Al-Saud. It is one rule and one family in any case. Anyhow, Mr. Hussein Al-Radi is in prison because of his expression of a comprehensive Islamic position and for his refusal to go to war with Yemen. Who can hear anything today about Sheikh Hussein Al-Radi? There is understandable fear in the heart of the community members of those imprisoned dissents or their relatives. They are afraid to reveal what is happening to the families of the dissents or to those who are related to them, for fear that collective punishment against the families will be carried out, and that the sentences against the prisoners might get doubled. There's a policy of intimidation practiced to silence mouths and to completely cover up the crimes that are taking place inside Saudi Arabia. Entire regions are being erased. We are not only talking about Awamiya and Qatif, which are mostly Shia-inhabited areas, but there are areas in the southern part of the kingdom that were completely exterminated, which were inhabited by Sunni tribes. They were all annihilated at the request of Mohammed bin Salman.
Well, it seems that this is how Mohammed bin Salman views modernity, unfortunately, but this is all the time that we have for this, but I promise that we will talk more about this, hopefully with you in the future. Ms. Isra Al-Fas, a human rights advocate, talking to us from London about the human rights record in Saudi Arabia that is just plummeting day after day. I want to thank you very much, ladies and gents, for following us and for watching the Mideast stream. Please do follow us on Telegram and on Twitter, and do subscribe to my YouTube channel, and I hope to deliver to you every week the newest form of anything that's going on in West Asia, but basically the voice of the oppressed people, because we are their voices. No matter how they try to sanction us, no matter how they try to silence us, we will remain to be the voice of the voiceless. Thank you for Assalamu alaikum.
In the limelight. Britain's electricity generators have been forced to warm up, polluting coal-fired power stations for the second time this winter after a sustained period of cold weather and lower wind generation. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. British households will be paid to cut their electricity use for the first time on Monday, 23rd of January, between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m., under plans being drawn up by the National Grid. as temperatures plummet to -2 degrees Celsius, ramping up pressure on Britain's supplies, the power network operator is planning to call on consumers to use less electricity to help it manage the system. Around 1 million people have signed up to the scheme, which will see them paid as much as £10 a day to cut the amount of electricity they use at certain times as part of efforts to tackle the energy crisis. This could mean, for example, not running the washing machine or the dishwasher during 5 to 6 p.m. or waiting to charge an electric car until nighttime. The scheme has previously been trialled, but proposals to use it at a time of high demand have never reached this stage of planning before. Energy sources last night said agreements linked to the plans had been made with suppliers that could not be reneged upon. In a further sign of strain on Britain's energy supply, the National Grid has also asked extra coal-fired power plants to be ready to supply backup electricity on Monday evening, 23rd of January, if needed. National Grid's electricity system operator, ESO, said it was activating the program, known as Demand Flexibility Service, between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. on Monday, 23rd of January. A spokesman said, "Our forecasts show electricity supply margins are expected to be tighter than normal on Monday evening. This does not mean electricity supplies are at risk and people should not be worried. These are precautionary measures to maintain the buffer of spare capacity that we need." The National Grid introduced the Demand Flexibility Service last year amid concern over power supplies this winter due to disruption to gas markets caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict, as well as outages on France's nuclear fleet.